at which point their gaze would flicker towards him, even while they remained in conversation with someone else. They wouldn't talk about him, though, because that would be rude. As we moved through the foyer of the Symphony Hall, where clusters of smart people stood with handbags and programmes in one hand, gin and tonics in the other, I saw this response pass through them in a gentle ripple, which followed us to the stalls. I don't know if Will noticed it. Sometimes I thought the only way he could deal with it was to pretend he could see none of it. We sat down, the only two people at the front in the centre block of seats. To our right, there was another man in a wheelchair, chatting cheerfully to two women who flanked him. I watched them, hoping that Will would notice them too. But he stared ahead, his head dipped into his shoulders, as if he were trying to become invisible. "This isn't going to work," a little voice said.
"Do you need anything?"
I whispered.
"No."
He shook his head. He swallowed.
"Actually, yes. Something's digging into my collar."
I leant over and ran my finger around the inside of it. A nylon tag had been left inside. I pulled at it, hoping to snap it, but it proved stubbornly resistant.
"New shirt. Is it really troubling you?"
"No, I just thought I'd bring it up for fun."
"Do we have any scissors in the bag?"
"I don't know, Clark. Believe it or not, I rarely pack it myself."
There were no scissors. I glanced behind me, where the audience were still settling themselves into their seats, murmuring and scanning their programmes. If Will couldn't relax and focus on the music, the outing would be wasted. I couldn't afford a second disaster.
"Don't move," I said.
"Why?"
Before he could finish, I leant across, gently peeled his collar from the side of his neck, placed my mouth against it, and took the offending tag between my front teeth. It took me a few seconds to bite through it, and I closed my eyes, trying to ignore the scent of clean mail, the feel of his skin against mine, the incongruity of what I was doing. And then finally, I felt it give. I pulled back my head and opened my eyes, triumphant, with the freed tag between my front teeth.
"Got it,"
I said, pulling the tag from my teeth and flicking it across the seats. Will stared at me.
"What?"
I swiveled in my chair to catch those audience members who suddenly seemed to find their programmes absolutely fascinating. Then I turned back to Will. "Oh, come on. It's not as if they've never seen a girl nibbling a bloke's collar before." I seemed to have briefly silenced him. Will blinked a couple of times, made as if to shake his head. I noticed with amusement that his neck had coloured a deep red. I straightened my skirt.
"Anyway," I said, "I think we should both just be grateful that it wasn't in your trousers."
And then, before he could respond, the orchestra walked out in their dinner jackets and cocktail dresses, and the audience hushed. I felt a little flutter of excitement despite myself. I placed my hands together on my lap, sat up in my seat. They began to tune up, and suddenly the auditorium was filled with a single sound, the most alive, three-dimensional thing I had ever heard. It made the hairs on my skin stand up, my breath catch in my throat. Will looked sideways at me, his face still carrying the mirth of the last few moments. "Okay," his expression said, "we're going to enjoy this." The conductor stepped up, tapped twice on the rostrum, and a great hush descended. I felt the stillness, the auditorium alive, expectant. Then he brought down his baton, and suddenly everything was pure sound. I felt the music like a physical thing. It didn't just sit in my ears. It flowed through me, around me, made my senses vibrate. It made my skin prickle and my palms dampen. Will hadn't described any of it like this. I had thought I might be bored. It was the most beautiful thing I had ever heard. And it made my imagination do unexpected things. As I sat there, I found myself thinking of things I hadn't thought of for years. Old emotions washing over me. New thoughts and ideas being pulled from me, as if my perception itself were being stretched out of shape. It was almost too much, but I didn't want it to stop. I wanted to sit there forever. I stole a look at Will. He was rapt, suddenly unself-conscious. I turned away, unexpectedly afraid to look at him. I was afraid of what he might be feeling, the depth of his loss, the extent of his fears. Will Traynor's life had been so far beyond the experiences of mine. Who was I to tell him how he should want to live it? Will's friend left a note asking us to go backstage and see him afterwards, but Will didn't want to. I urged him once, but I could see from the set of his jaw that he would not be budged. I couldn't blame him. I remembered how his former workmates had looked at him that day. That mixture of pity, revulsion, and somewhere, deep relief that they themselves had somehow escaped this particular stroke of fate. I suspected there were only so many of those sorts of meetings he could stomach. We waited until the auditorium was empty. Then I wheeled him out, down to the car park in the lift, and loaded Will up without incident. I didn't say much. My head was still ringing with the music, and I didn't want it to fade. I kept thinking back to it, the way that Will's friend had been so lost in what he was playing. I hadn't realised that music could unlock things in you, could transport you to somewhere even the composer hadn't predicted. It left an imprint in the air around you, as if you carried its remnants with you when you went. For some time, as we sat there in the audience, I had completely forgotten Will was even beside me. We pulled up outside the annex. In front of us, just visible above the wall, the castle sat, floodlit under the full moon, gazing serenely down from its position on the top of the hill.
So you're not a classical music person?
I looked into the rear-view mirror. Will was smiling. I didn't enjoy that in the slightest.
I could tell.
I especially didn't enjoy that bit near the end, the bit where the violin was singing by itself.
I could see you didn't like that bit. In fact, I think you had tears in your eyes, you hated it so much.
I grinned back at him. I really loved it, I said. I'm not sure I'd like all classical music, but I thought that was amazing. I rubbed my nose. Thank you. Thank you for taking me. We sat in silence, gazing at the castle. Normally at night, it was bathed in a kind of orange glow from the lights dotted around the fortress wall. But tonight, under a full moon, It seemed flooded in an ethereal blue.
What kind of music would they have played there, do you think?
I said. They must have listened to something.
The castle? Medieval stuff. Lutes, strings. Not my cup of tea, but I've got some I can lend you if you like. You should walk around the castle with it on earphones if you really wanted the full experience.
Nah, I don't really go to the castle.
It's always the way when you live close by somewhere.
My answer was non-committal. We sat there a moment longer, listening to the engine tick its way to silence. Right, I said, unfastening my belt. We'd better get you in. The evening routine awaits.
Just wait a minute, Clark.
I turned in my seat. Will's face was in shadow, and I couldn't quite make it out.
Just hold on. Just for a minute.
Are you all right? I found my gaze dropping towards his chair, afraid some part of him was pinched or trapped, that I'd got something wrong.
I'm fine. I just...
I could see his pale collar, his dark suit jacket a contrast against it.
I don't want to go in just yet. I just want to sit and not have to think about...
He swallowed. Even in the half dark, it seemed effortful.
I just want to be a man who has been to a concert with a girl in a red dress. Just for a few minutes more.
I released the door handle.
Sure.
I closed my eyes and lay my head against the headrest, and we sat there together for a while longer. Two people lost in remembered music, half hidden in the shadow of a castle on a moonlit hill. My sister and I never really talked about what happened that night at the maze. I'm not entirely sure we had the words. She held me for a bit, then spent some time helping me find my clothes, and then searched in vain in the long grass for my shoes until I told her that it really didn't matter. I wouldn't have worn them again anyway. And then we walked home slowly. Me in my bare feet, her with her arm linked through mine, even though we hadn't walked like that since she was in her first year at school and Mum had insisted I never let her go. When we got home, we stood on the porch, and she wiped at my hair and then at my eyes with a damp tissue. And then we unlocked the front door and walked in as if nothing had happened. Dab was still up, watching some football match.
You girls are a bit late,
he called out.
I know it's a Friday, but still...
Okay, Dad,
we called out in unison. Back then, I had the room that is now Grandad's. I walked swiftly upstairs, and before my sister could say a word, I closed the door behind me. I chopped all my hair off the following week. I cancelled my plane ticket. I didn't go out with the girls from my old school again. Mum was too sunk in her own grief to notice, and Dad put any change in mood in our house and my new habit of locking myself in my bedroom down to women's problems. I had worked out who I was, and it was someone very different from the giggling girl who got drunk with strangers. It was someone who wore nothing that could be construed as suggestive, clothes that would not appeal to the kind of men who went to the Red Lion anyway.
life returned to normal. I took a job at the hairdresser's, then the buttered bun, and put it all behind me. I must have walked past the castle 5,000 times since that day. But I have never been to the maze since. Chapter 13. Patrick stood on the edge of the track, jogging on the spot, his new Nike t-shirt and shorts sticking slightly to his damp limbs. I had stopped by to say hello and to tell him that I wouldn't be at the Triathlon Terrors meeting at the pub that evening. Nathan was off, and I had stepped in to take over the evening routine. That's three meetings you've missed.
Is it?
I counted back on my fingers.
I suppose it is.
You'll have to come next week. It's all the travel plans for the Extreme Viking. And you haven't told me what you want to do for your birthday.
He began to do his stretches, lifting his leg high and pressing his chest to his knee.
I thought maybe the cinema. I don't want to do a big meal, not while I'm training.
Ah, Mum and Dad are planning a special dinner.
He grabbed at his heel, pointing his knee to the ground. I couldn't help but notice that his leg was becoming weirdly sinewy.
It's not exactly a night out, is it?
Well, nor is the multiplex. Anyway, I feel like I should, Patrick. Mum's been a bit down.
Trina had moved out the previous weekend, minus my lemons wash bag. I retrieved that the night before she went. Mum was devastated. It was actually worse than when Trina had gone to university the first time around. She missed Thomas like an amputated limb. His toys, which had littered the living room floor since babyhood, were boxed up and put away. There were no chocolate fingers or small cartons of drink in the cupboard. She no longer had a reason to walk to the school at 3:15 p.m. Nobody to chat to on the short walk home. It had been the only time Mum ever really spent outside the house. Now she went nowhere at all, apart from the weekly supermarket shop with Dad. She floated around the house looking a bit lost for 3 days. Then she began spring cleaning with a vigour that frightened even Grandad. He would mouth gummy protests at her as she tried to vacuum under the chair that he was still sitting in, or flick at his shoulders with her duster. Trina had said she wouldn't come home for the first few weeks, just to give Thomas a chance to settle. When she rang each evening, Mum would speak to them, and then cry for a full half hour in her bedroom afterwards.
"You're always working late these days. I feel like I hardly see you."
"Well, you're always training. Anyway, it's good money, Patrick. I'm hardly going to say no to the overtime."
He couldn't argue with that.
I was earning more than I had ever earned in my life. I doubled the amount I gave my parents, put some aside into a savings account every month, and I was still left with more than I could spend. Part of it was I worked so many hours that I was never away from Granter House when the shops were open. The other was, simply, that I didn't really have an appetite for spending. The spare hours I did have, I had started to spend in the library, looking things up on the internet. There was a whole world available to me from that PC. Layer upon layer of it. And it had begun to exert a siren call. It had started with the thank you letter. A couple of days after the concert, I told Will I thought we should write and thank his friend, the violinist. "I bought a nice card on the way in," I said. "You tell me what you want to say, and I'll write it. I've even brought in my good pen."
"I don't think so,"
Will said.
"What?"
You heard me.
You don't think so? That man gave us front-of-house seats. You said yourself it was fantastic. The least you could do is thank him.
Will's jaw was fixed, immovable. I put down my pen.
Or are you just so used to people giving you stuff that you don't feel you have to?
You have no idea, Clark, how frustrating it is to rely on someone else to put your words down for you. The phrase, written on behalf of, is humiliating.
Yeah? Well, it's still better than a great big fat nothing, I grumbled.
I'm going to thank him anyway. I won't mention your name if you really want to be an arse about it.
I wrote the card and posted it. I said nothing more about it. But that evening, Will's words still echoing around my head, I found myself diverting into the library and spying an unused computer, I logged onto the internet. I looked up whether there were any devices that Will could use to do his own writing. Within an hour, I had come up with three. A piece of voice recognition software, another type of software which relied on the blinking of an eye, and, as my sister had mentioned, a tapping device that Will could wear on his head. He was predictably sniffy about the head device, but he conceded that the voice recognition software might be useful, and within a week we managed, with Nathan's help, to install it on his computer, setting Will up so that with the computer tray fixed to his chair, he no longer needed someone else to type for him. He was a bit self-conscious about it initially, but after I instructed him to begin everything with, "Take a letter, Miss Clark," he got over it. Even Mrs. Traynor couldn't find anything to complain about.
"If there is any other equipment that you think might be useful," she said, her lips still pursed as if she couldn't quite believe this might have been a straightforwardly good thing, "do let us know."
She eyed Will nervously, as if he might actually be about to wrench it off with his jaw. 3 days later, just as I set off for work, the postman handed me a letter. I opened it on the bus, thinking it might be an early birthday card from some distant cousin. It read, in computerized text,
"Dear Clark, this is to show you that I am not an entirely selfish arse, and I do appreciate your efforts. Thank you. Will." I laughed so hard the bus driver asked me if my lottery numbers had come up. After years spent in that box room, my clothes perched on a rail in the hallway outside, Trina's bedroom felt palatial. The first night I spent in it, I spun round with my arms outstretched, just luxuriating in the fact that I couldn't touch both walls simultaneously. I went to the DIY store and bought paint and new blinds, as well as a new bedside light and some shelves, which I assembled myself. It's not that I'm good at that stuff. I guess I just wanted to see if I could do it. I set about redecorating, painting for an hour a night after I came home from work, and at the end of the week, even Dad had to admit I'd done a really good job. He stared for a bit at my cutting in, fingered the blinds that I had put up myself, and put a hand on my shoulder.
"This job has been the making of you, Lou."
I bought a new duvet cover, a rug, and some oversized cushions, just in case anyone ever stopped by and fancied lounging. Not that anyone did. The calendar went on the back of the new door. Nobody saw it, except for me. Nobody else would have known what it meant anyway. I did feel a bit bad about the fact that once we had put Thomas's camp bed up next to Trina's in the box room, there wasn't actually any floor space left.
But then I rationalised they didn't even really live here anymore. And the box room was somewhere they were only going to sleep. There was no point in the larger room being empty for weeks on end. I went to work each day thinking about other places I could take Will. I didn't have any overall plan. I just focused each day on getting him out and about and trying to keep him happy. There were some days, days when his limbs burnt or when infection claimed him and he lay miserable and feverish in bed, that were harder than others. But on the good days, I had managed several times to get him out into the spring sunshine. I knew now that one of the things Will hated most was the pity of strangers. So I drove him to local beauty spots, where for an hour or so it could be just the two of us. I made picnics, and we sat out on the edges of fields, just enjoying the breeze and being away from the annex. "My boyfriend wants to meet you," I told him one afternoon, breaking off pieces of cheese and pickle sandwich for him. I had driven several miles out of town, up onto a hill, and we could see the castle across the valley opposite, separated from us by fields of lambs.
"Why?"
"He wants to know who I'm spending all these late nights with." Oddly, I could see he found this quite cheering.
"Running man."
"I think my parents do too.
I get nervous when a girl says she wants me to meet her parents. How is your mum anyway?"
"The same."
"Your dad's job? Any news?"
"No. Next week they're telling him now. Anyway, they said, did I want to invite you to my birthday dinner on Friday? All very relaxed, just family, really. But it's fine. I said you wouldn't want to."
"Who says I wouldn't want to?"
You hate strangers, you don't like eating in front of people, and you don't like the sound of my boyfriend. It seems like a no-brainer to me." I had worked him out now. The best way to get Will to do anything was to tell him you knew he wouldn't want to. Some obstinate, contrary part of him still couldn't bear it. Will chewed for a minute.
"No, I'll come to your birthday. It'll give your mother something to focus on, if nothing else."
"Really? Oh, God. If I tell her, she'll start polishing and dusting this evening."
"Are you sure she's your biological mother? Isn't there supposed to be some kind of genetic similarity there? Sandwich, please, Clark. And more pickle on the next bit."
I had been only half joking. Mum went into a complete tailspin at the thought of hosting a quadriplegic. Her hands flew to her face, and then she started rearranging stuff on the dresser as if he were going to arrive within minutes of me telling her. "But what if he needs to go to the loo? We don't have a downstairs bathroom. I don't think Daddy would be able to carry him upstairs. I could help, but I'd feel a bit worried about where to put my hands. Would Patrick do it?"
"You don't need to worry about that side of things, really."
"And what about his food? Will he need his pureed? Is there anything he can't eat?"
"No, he just needs help picking it up."
"Who's going to do that?"
"I will. Relax, Mum. He's nice. You'll like him."
And so it was arranged. Nathan would pick Will up and drive him over, and would come by 2 hours later to take him home again and run through the nighttime routine. I had offered, but they both insisted I should let my hair down on my birthday. They plainly hadn't met my parents.
At 7:30 on the dot, I opened the door to find Will and Nathan in the front porch. Will was wearing his smart shirt and jacket. I didn't know whether to be pleased that he had made the effort or worried that my mum would now spend the first 2 hours of the night worrying that she hadn't dressed smartly enough.
Hey, you.
My dad emerged into the hallway behind me.
Aha! Was the ramp okay, lads?
He had spent all afternoon making the particle board ramp for the outside steps. Nathan carefully negotiated Will's chair up and into our narrow hallway.
Nice,
Nathan said as I closed the door behind him.
Very nice. I've seen worse in hospitals. Bernard Clark.
Dad reached out and shook Nathan's hand. He held it out towards Will before snatching it away again with a sudden flush of embarrassment.
Bernard, sorry, I don't know how to greet her. I can't shake you.
He began to stutter.
A curtsy will be fine.
Dad stared at him. And then when he realised Will was joking, he let out a great laugh of relief.
Ha! Ah!
He said and clapped Will on the shoulder.
Yes, curtsy. Nice one.
It broke the ice. Nathan left with a wave and a wink, and I wheeled Will through to the kitchen. Mum, luckily, was holding a casserole dish, which absolved her of the same anxiety.
Mum, this is Will.
Will, Josephine.
Josie, please.
She beamed at him, her oven gloves up to her elbows.
Lovely to meet you finally, Will.
Pleased to meet you, he said. Don't let me interrupt.
She put down the dish and her hand went to her hair. Always a good sign with my mother. It was a shame she hadn't remembered to take an oven glove off first.
Sorry, she said. Roast dinner. It's all in the timing, you know.
Not really,
Will said.
I'm not a cook, but I love good food. It's why I've been looking forward to tonight.
So,
Dad opened the fridge.
How do we do this? Do you have a special beer cup, Will?
If it was Dad, I told Will, he would have had an adapted beer cup before he had a wheelchair.
Got to get your priorities right,
Dad said. I rummaged in Will's bag until I found his beaker.
Beer will be fine. Thank you.
He took a sip, and I stood in the kitchen, suddenly conscious of our tiny, shabby house with its 1980s wallpaper and dented kitchen cupboards. Will's home was elegantly furnished, its things sparse and beautiful. Our house looked as if 90% of its contents came from the local pound shop. Thomas's dog-eared paintings covered every spare surface of wall. But if he had noticed, Will said nothing. He and Dad had quickly found a shared point of reference, which turned out to be my general uselessness. I didn't mind. It kept them both happy.
Did you know she once drove backwards into a bollard and swore it was the bollard's fault?
You want to see her lowering my ramp. It's like Ski Sunday coming out of that car sometimes.
Dad burst out laughing. I left them to it. Mum followed me out, fretting. She put a tray of glasses onto the dining table, then glanced up at the clock.
Where's Patrick?
He was coming straight from training, I said. Perhaps he's been held up.
He couldn't put it off just for your birthday.
This chicken is going to be spoilt if he's much longer.
Mum, it will be fine.
I waited until she had put the tray down, and then I slid my arms around her and gave her a hug. She was rigid with anxiety. I felt a sudden wave of sympathy for her. It couldn't be easy being my mother. Really, it will be fine. She let go of me, kissed the top of my head, and brushed her hands down her apron. I wish your sister was here. It seems wrong to have a celebration without her. Not to me, it didn't. Just for once, I was quite enjoying being the focus of attention. It might sound childish, but it was true. I loved having Will and Dad laughing about me. I loved the fact that every element of supper, from roast chicken to chocolate mousse, was my favourite. I liked the fact that I could be who I wanted to be without my sister's voice reminding me of who I had been. The doorbell rang and Mum flapped her hands. There he is! Lou, why don't you start serving? Patrick was still flushed from his exertions at the track.
Happy birthday, babe,
he said, stooping to kiss me. He smelt of aftershave and deodorant and warm, recently showered skin. Best go straight through. I nodded towards the living room. Mum's having a timing meltdown. Oh, he glanced down at his watch. Sorry, must have lost track of time. Not your time, though, eh? What? Nothing. Dad had moved the big gate-leg table into the living room. He had also, on my instruction, moved one of the sofas to the other wall, so that Will would be able to enter the room unobstructed. He manoeuvred his wheelchair to the placing I pointed to, and then elevated himself a little, so that he would be at the same height as everyone else. I sat on his left, and Patrick sat opposite. He and Will and Grandad nodded their hellos. I had already warned Patrick not to try to shake his hand. Even as I sat down, I could feel Will studying Patrick, and I wondered briefly whether he would be as charming to my boyfriend as he had been to my parents. Will inclined his head towards me.
If you look in the back of the chair, there's a little something for the dinner.
I leant back and reached my hand downwards into his bag. I pulled it up again, retrieving a bottle of Laurent Perrier champagne.
You should always have champagne on your birthday, he said.
Oh, look at that,
Mum said, bringing in the plates.
How lovely. Oh, but we have no champagne glasses.
These will be fine, Will said.
I'll open it.
Patrick reached for it, unwound the wire, and placed his thumbs under the cork. He kept glancing over at Will, as if he were not what he had expected at all.
If you do that, Will observed, it's going to go everywhere.
He lifted his arm an inch or so, gesturing vaguely.
I find that holding the cork and turning the bottle tends to be a safer bet.
There's a man who knows his champagne,
Dad said.
There you go, Patrick. Turning the bottle, you say? Well, who knew?
I knew, Patrick said. That's how I was going to do it.
The champagne was safely popped and poured, and my birthday was toasted. Grandad called out something that may well have been,
"Hear, hear!"
I stood up and bowed. I was wearing a 1960s yellow A-line mini dress I had got from the charity shop.
The woman had thought it might be Bieber, although someone had cut the label out.
"May this be the year our Lou finally grows up," Dad said. "I was going to say, does something with her life, but it seems like she finally is. I have to say, Will, since she's had the job with you, she's, well, she's really come out of herself."
"We're very proud," Mum said.
"And grateful to you for employing her, I mean."
"Gratitude's all mine," Will said.
He glanced sideways at me.
"To Lou,"
Dad said.
"And her continued success."
"And to absent family members," Mum said.
"Blimey," I said. "I should have a birthday more often. Most days you all just hurl abuse at me."
They began to talk, Dad telling some other story against me that made him and Mum laugh out loud. It was good to see them laughing. Dad had looked so worn down these last weeks, and Mum had been hollow-eyed and distracted, as if her real self were always elsewhere. I wanted to savour these moments, of them briefly forgetting their troubles, in shared jokes and familial fondness. Just for a moment, I realised I wouldn't have minded if Thomas was there, or Trina, for that matter. I was so lost in my thoughts that it took a minute to register Patrick's expression. I was feeding Will as I said something to Grandad, folding a piece of smoked salmon in my fingers and placing it to Will's lips. It was such an unthinking part of my daily life now that the intimacy of the gesture only struck me when I saw the shock on Patrick's face. Will said something to Dad, and I stared at Patrick, willing him to stop. On his left, Grandad was picking at his plate with greedy delight, letting out what we called his food noises, little grunts and murmurs of pleasure.
"Delicious salmon," Will said to my mother. "Really lovely flavour."
"Well, it's not something we would have every day," she said, smiling. "But we did want to make today special."
"Stop staring," I told Patrick silently. Finally, he caught my eye and looked away. He looked furious. I fed Will another piece, and then some bread when I saw him glance at it. I had, I realised in that moment, become so attuned to Will's needs that I barely needed to look at him to work out what he wanted. Patrick, opposite, ate with his head down, cutting the smoked salmon into small pieces and spearing them with his fork. He left his bread.
"So, Patrick,"
Will said, perhaps sensing my discomfort.
"Louisa tells me you're a personal trainer. What does that involve?"
I so wish he hadn't asked. Patrick launched into his sales spiel, all about personal motivation and how a fit body made for a healthy mind. Then he segued into his training schedule for the extreme Viking, the temperatures of the North Sea, the body fat ratios needed for marathon running, his best times in each discipline. I normally tuned out at this point, but all I could think of now, with Will beside me, was how inappropriate it was. Why couldn't he have just said something vague and left it at that?
"In fact, when Lou said you were coming, I thought I'd take a look at my books and see if there was any physio I could recommend."
I choked on my champagne.
"It's quite specialist, Patrick. I'm not sure you'd really be the person."
"I can do specialist. I do sports injuries. I have medical training."
This is not a sprained ankle, Pat. Really.
There's a man I worked with a couple of years ago. Had a client who was paraplegic. He's almost fully recovered now, he says. Does triathlons and everything.
Fancy, said my mother.
He pointed me to this new research in Canada that says muscles can be trained to remember former activity. If you get them working enough every day, it's like a brain synapse. It can come back. I bet you if we hooked you up with a really good regime, you could see a difference in your muscle memory. After all, Lou tells me you were quite the action man before.
Patrick, I said loudly, you know nothing about it.
I was just trying to...
Well, don't. Really.
The table fell silent. Dad coughed and excused himself for it. Grandad peered around the table in wary silence. Mum made as if to offer everyone more bread and then seemed to change her mind. When Patrick spoke again, there was a faint air of martyrdom in his tone.
It's just research that I thought might be helpful, but I'll say no more about it.
Will looked up and smiled, his face blank, polite.
I'll certainly bear it in mind.
I got up to clear the plates, wanting to escape the table. But Mum scolded me, telling me to sit down.
You're the birthday girl, she said,
as if she ever let anyone else do anything anyway.
Bernard, why don't you go and get the chicken?
Ah-ha! Let's hope it stopped flapping around now, eh?
Dad smiled, his teeth bared in a kind of grimace. The rest of the meal passed off without incident. My parents, I could see, were completely charmed by Will. Patrick, less so. He and Will barely exchanged another word. Somewhere around the point where Mum served up the roast potatoes, Dad doing his usual thing of trying to steal extras, I stopped worrying. Dad was asking Will all sorts, about his life before, even about the accident, and he seemed comfortable enough to answer him directly. In fact, I learnt a fair bit that he'd never told me. His job, for example, sounded pretty important, even if he played it down. He bought and sold companies and made sure he turned a profit while doing so. It took Dad a few attempts to prise out of him that his idea of a profit ran into 6 or 7 figures. I found myself staring at Will, trying to reconcile the man I knew with this ruthless city suit that he now described. Dad told him about the company that was about to take over the furniture factory, and when he said the name, Will nodded almost apologetically and said that yes, he knew of them. Yes, he would probably have gone for it too. The way he said it didn't sound promising for Dad's job. Mum just cooed at Will and made a huge fuss of him. I realised, watching her smile, that at some stage during the meal he had just become a smart young man at her table. No wonder Patrick was pissed off.
Birthday cake!
Grandad said as she began to clear the dishes. It was so distinct, so surprising, that Dad and I stared at each other in shock. The whole table went quiet. No, I walked around the table and kissed him. No, Grandad, sorry, but it is chocolate mousse. You like that? He nodded in approval. My mother was beaming.
I don't think any of us could have had a better present. The mousse arrived on the table, and with it, a large square present about the size of a telephone directory, wrapped in tissue.
Presents, is it?
Patrick said.
Here's mine.
He smiled at me as he placed it in the middle of the table. I raised a smile back. This was no time to argue, after all.
Go on,
said Dad.
Open it.
I opened theirs first, peeling the paper carefully away so that I didn't tear it. It was a photograph album, and on every page there was a picture from a year in my life. Me as a baby, me and Trina as solemn, chubby-faced girls, me on my first day at secondary school, all hair clips and oversized skirt. More recently, there was a picture of me and Patrick, the one where I was actually telling him to piss off. And me, dressed in a grey skirt, my first day in my new job. In between the pages were pictures of our family by Thomas. Letters that Mum had kept from school trips. My childish handwriting telling of days on the beach, lost ice creams and thieving gulls. I flicked through and only hesitated briefly when I saw the girl with the long, dark, flicked back hair. I turned the page.
Can I see?
Will said. It's not been the best year, Mum told him as I flicked through the pages in front of him. I mean, we're fine and everything, but, you know, things being what they are. And then Grandad saw something on the daytime telly about making your own presents, and I thought that was something that would, you know, really mean something. It does, Mum. My eyes had filled with tears. I love it. Thank you. Grandad picked out some of the pictures, she said.
It's beautiful,
said Will. I love it, I said again. The look of utter relief she and Dad exchanged was the saddest thing I've ever seen.
Mine next.
Patrick pushed the little box across the table. I opened it slowly, feeling vaguely panicked for a moment that it might be an engagement ring. I wasn't ready. I had barely got my head around having my own bedroom. I opened the little box, and there, against the dark blue velvet, was a thin gold chain with a little star pendant. It was sweet, delicate, and not remotely me. I didn't wear that kind of jewellery. Never had. I let my eyes rest on it while I worked out what to say. It's lovely, I said as he leant across the table and fastened it around my neck.
Glad you like it,
Patrick said, and kissed me on the mouth. I swear he'd never kissed me like that in front of my parents before. Will watched me, his face impassive.
Well, I think we should eat pudding now,
Dad said,
before it gets too hot.
He laughed out loud at his own joke. The champagne had boosted his spirits immeasurably.
There's something in my bag for you too, Will said quietly. The one on the back of my chair. It's in orange wrapping.
I pulled the present from Will's backpack. My mother paused, the serving spoon in her hand.
You got Lou a present, Will? That's ever so kind of you.
Isn't that kind of him, Bernard?
It certainly is.
The wrapping paper had brightly coloured Chinese kimonos on it. I didn't have to look at it to know I would save it. Perhaps even create something to wear based on it. I removed the ribbon, putting it to one side for later. I opened the paper and then the tissue paper within it. And there, staring at me, was a strangely familiar black and yellow stripe. I pulled the fabric from the parcel, and in my hands were two pairs of black and yellow tights, adult-sized, opaque, in a wool so soft that they almost slid through my fingers. "I don't believe it," I said. I had started to laugh, a joyous, unexpected thing. "Oh, my God! Where did you get these?"
"I had them made. You'll be happy to know I instructed the woman via my brand new voice recognition software."
"Tights!"
Dad and Patrick said in unison.
"Only the best pair of tights ever."
My mother peered at them. "You know, Louisa, I'm pretty sure you had a pair just like that when you were very little."
Will and I exchanged a look.
I couldn't stop beaming.
"I want to put them on now," I said.
"Jesus Christ! She'll look like Max Wall in a beehive,"
my father said, shaking his head.
"Ah, Bernard, it's her birthday. Sure she can wear what she wants."
I ran outside and pulled on a pair in the hallway. I pointed a toe, admiring the silliness of them. I don't think a present had ever made me so happy in my life. I walked back in. Will let out a small cheer. Grandad banged his hands on the table. Mum and Dad burst out laughing. Patrick just stared.
"Oh, I can't even begin to tell you how much I love these," I said. "Thank you, thank you."
I reached out a hand and touched the back of his shoulder. "Really?"
"There's a card in there too," he said. "Open it some other time."
My parents made a huge fuss of Will when he left. Dad, who was drunk, kept thanking him for employing me and made him promise to come back.
"If I lose my job, maybe I'll come over and watch the footy with you one day," he said.
"I'd like that,"
said Will, even though I'd never seen him watch a football match. My mum pressed some leftover mousse on him, wrapping it in a Tupperware container. "Seeing as you liked it so much."
"What a gentleman," they would say, for a good hour after he had gone. "A real gentleman."
Patrick came out to the hallway, his hands shoved deep in his pockets, as if perhaps to stop the urge to shake Will's own. That was my more generous conclusion.
"Good to meet you, Patrick," Will said. "And thank you for the advice."
"Oh, just trying to help my girlfriend get the best out of her job," he said. "That's all."
There was a definite emphasis on the word "my."
"Well, you're a lucky man,"
Will said as Nathan began to steer him out.
"She certainly gives a good bed bath."
He said it so quickly that the door was closed before Patrick even realised what he had said.
"You never told me you were giving him bed baths."
We had gone back to Patrick's house,
a new-built flat on the edge of town. It had been marketed as loft living, even though it overlooked the retail park and was no more than 3 floors high.
What does that